I'm Georgie Crawford. This is the Good Glow Podcast. Following a cancer diagnosis in my 30s, my goal is to inspire and empower people on their self-care journey. Through the conversations I have with my guests, we hope to do just that.
There is a plan, and believe that if you're at rock bottom and you're suffering, this is all part of your life, your tapestry. This is your story, and where you go next is what's crucial.
The love before was easy, but the love at my lowest was real.
We all know what makes us happy. We all know the life we dreamed about. And deep down, we all know what we're capable of if you only give yourself permission to do it.
I now live a healthy and fulfilled life where self-care is a top priority and every day is an opportunity to grow. This season, I'm so proud to say I've teamed up with Vichy. Vichy is an expert French pharmacy dermocosmetic brand. Doctor-founded Vichy has established the link between health and beauty and led the way in skincare innovation for 90 years. Powered by active ingredients, all product formulations are clinically proven, hypoallergenic and dermatologically tested for sensitive skin, making Vichy a pioneer in skin health science. Taking a holistic approach to skin health, Vichy is committed to provide safe and effective skincare routines for every skin type at every life stage. All Vichy products are available in local pharmacies nationwide. Welcome to a special episode of the Good Glow Podcast with two amazing girls, Emma Cassidy and Martine Dines. One in nine women will be diagnosed with breast cancer. When I was told my news, I thought my life was over. Now, when I look back, I see it was only just beginning, but I know I am one of the lucky ones. Emma was diagnosed just before me. She reached out to me, and it was so nice to hear from somebody who was on the same path. We found out that our brothers were friends. We had so much in common. And just to know that I had a friend who understood exactly what I was going through, losing my hair and things like that, it meant so much. And we just became so close. So today, Emma will tell me about her diagnosis, how she dealt with being told she had the BRCA gene, and how the most unexpected miracle took place when she least expected it. Right at the end of this episode, I catch up with Martine, who was 29 when she was diagnosed this summer, living in Australia in the middle of a pandemic. Her story is so gripping. Thousands of miles from her family, Martine and the Irish community down under campaigned for her mum and dad to be given permission to enter Australia, even though the borders were closed. This story is just so heartwarming. I especially loved the part where Martine tells me about her morning ritual and how it sets her up for each and every day. Before we get into it, I just wanted to say that if you are listening to this podcast and you're often stressed out or worried, too hard on yourself, I think I'm certainly guilty of that. I'm urging you to give yourself a break, because this is a reminder that every day of this life is a gift. So take some time to give yourself a pat on the back from time to time. Acknowledge all that you do, because you're doing a great job and you are enough. True healing begins when we choose self-love over self-judgment, and I certainly needed to hear that today. We're all doing a great job, and when we lift each other up, incredible things can happen. So I hope you enjoy this podcast. I hope your heart is filled with love after it, and I hope you're smiling by the end of it, because I was. It's so heartwarming. So anyway, I hope you enjoy it.
Emma, thank you so much for being on the Good Glow today.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
One of the things that I always think about when I think of your story, and it's a real standout moment for me along your journey, is that, would you say that your GP saved your life?
Oh, without a doubt, my GP saved my life. I have an amazing relationship with my GP. He's been my doctor since I was a baby. So, you know, we would have a really special relationship all the way growing up. He'd know me so well. So when I went to him initially, I was just feeling very tired. The age I was, to be totally honest, I never checked my breasts. My friends never did. We didn't know anyone our age who had had breast cancer, like, you know, we were all so kind of oblivious to that world. You know, you're in your own little bubble, you're so carefree, and you just don't think that's ever going to happen to someone in your group. So he ran some like tests, just general blood tests and things like that. And, you know, I was getting some B12 injections to try and boost me up, but nothing was working. So he just said, listen, Emma, I know you. I know, you know, you shouldn't be this tired. You know, you're saying you're not feeling right. Let's get to the bottom of this. So we started trying to rule things out, like maybe thyroid issues. And then one day he just said out of nowhere, do you check your breasts? And I said, no, I don't. And he said, okay, I am going to get you an appointment with Professor Hill in Beaumont in the next 2 weeks. We're just going to see. And I don't know what made him do it. It sounds so strange. And anyone who I've talked to since has said, like, that is, wow, like, that is not where, you know, doctors might normally jump. But sure enough, 2 weeks later, I had the appointment, and they're so thorough, obviously. So the doctor, one of the doctors from the team examined me. He said there was kind of a lump quite deep in, but he said, he was even saying at the time, because of your age, I'm sure it's okay, but I'll send you downstairs for an ultrasound and then you'll just come back up to me and we'll have a look. Anyway, about 8 hours later, I was still there. Biopsies, mammograms, everything. And my mom was with me. And I just remember one moment really jumps out that, you know, we were sitting across from each other, and her phone battery was dying, I think. And one of the nurses just appeared and was saying, oh, I have a charger. Do you want me to charge your phone? You know, everyone is always so lovely in the hospital, but it just felt, I was being paranoid, but I felt like people were being extra nice to us. And I was wondering, oh, do they know something? Like, has something shown up already? So I remember the car journey home. It was about 6 o'clock that evening, and my mom and myself were both kind of quiet. And I just kind of turned to her and said, do you think this is okay, or do you think something is wrong? And I'd say her mind was racing even more than mine, you know, like I'm her only baby and we are like inseparable, very similar to the way you are with your mom. We're just so close, we're best friends. And she just said, Emma, I don't know. Part of me thought, okay, it must be something for all of this. And then you just kind of are nearly craving someone just to say, yeah, it's totally fine. Just so you can convince yourself for those few days until you get the results that, you know, it couldn't be.
Mm. Her honesty in that moment is, I really appreciated when people were honest with me, because I'd say, I feel like I have cancer, so can you just hear me out?
Yeah, don't fob me off. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's almost like she broke your fall in that moment.
Yeah, we're kind of very in tune, and she would have seen kind of how I was over the previous couple of months and would have known that something wasn't right. Obviously, she never would have thought cancer, but she definitely would have thought that something was up, but she couldn't put her finger on it. And then I remember I was going to one of my close friend's wedding a few days later. And that morning I got a call to say, your results won't be back until another week. And I said, OK, that's grand. So I think I was getting my hair and makeup done or something, and I thought, okay, that's fine. I can put it out of my mind and just enjoy my time with my friends. And then an hour later, I got another call to say, Professor Hill actually really wants to see you on Tuesday. Can you come in at 8:30 just before the clinic starts? And then I thought, okay, this is not good, especially when the main consultant wants to see it. You know, your mind straight away is thinking, okay, this is something. So I called my mom and told her, and I made the decision that I wasn't going to tell anybody else. I wanted to enjoy my day. I didn't want to tell any of my friends, because I didn't want that to become a focus on what was going to be an amazing day. So I put it out of my head, and I just, you know, part of me, I think, knew that it was going to be one of the last kind of carefree nights I was going to have in a while, which I know, saying it out loud now sounds kind of heartbreaking, but I just wanted to be me for that night and just be crazy and just, you know, enjoy myself and laugh. And that's what I did. And I just tried not to think about it until I went in, and then I was diagnosed about 3 days later.
So Professor Hill told you had cancer?
Yeah.
Yeah. Very, very similar. Yeah. How did he break the news to you?
So I went in, and as soon as I went into the room, I saw a nurse, and again, paranoid, I thought, oh, this isn't good. Like a running theme with me thinking this isn't good. But he had my scans up on the screen and my mammograms up on the screen, and he was kind of pointing out areas, and he just was saying, he kind of was repeating the word abnormality, 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 in like three different areas. And I was still kind of, you know, very naive, you know, never in my world did I think this would happen. But it was, my mom and myself were kind of looking at each other, and my mom just said, sorry, could I just ask, is abnormality, do you mean cancer? Is that kind of what you're trying to tell us here? And he just kind of nodded his head. I could see that obviously, you know, it's so, they're so amazing at what they do, but it's obviously such an incredibly tough part of your job to day in, day out, have to tell someone sitting in front of you, you know, a horrible diagnosis. And, you know, we were both still very calm at that point. I think I was, part of me still felt like, okay, he's just going to tell me that we're going to remove it and then that's it and that's fine. You know, again, trying to cling to something again, so naive. And then the next sentence was, so, you know, you're going to meet your surgeon, Mr. Power, and he's going to talk to you about the mastectomy. And my neck nearly like snapped off. I was just in shock. My mother was in shock. That was the moment when we were really upset, that straight away it jumped from, okay, you have this, to, okay, your breast is going to be removed, like in a matter of days or weeks. And there was no option not to do that. So it kind of straight away, you know, you're, every little sentence, you're losing more and more control over your body.
Your power is gone.
Everything just starts to kind of slip away, you know, one thing at a time. And I remember then, so we had a little cry, and obviously the nurse was so lovely and Professor Hill was so lovely. And he was saying, oh, and also your left breast, Deirdre Duke had done the scan for me, and she is so amazing. You know Deirdre really well, as well. I think she's done a lot of your scans too. And they had spotted on my left breast just an area that they wanted to check further. So at that point, you know, I was in tears, and I was just saying, you know, like sniveling, just saying, okay, yeah, I can do that today, yeah. And Professor Hill is saying to me, no, you're not getting that today. You need to process this. But I was just thinking, oh, like if you need me to get it done now, I can. You know, I was barely able to speak. So I'd say they were thinking, okay, just take a minute. So yeah, I just remember then leaving the hospital. Didn't really know what else was going to happen until was going to meet my surgeon. And I remember just being in the car, and our next thought was, who are we going to tell? How do we process this ourselves, let alone telling people?
Mm.
Because that, you know, you probably found the same. The telling people is horrendous, because every time you tell someone, it's making everything that bit more real. And then it's like, oh, I actually have to face up that this is happening to me.
Mm.
And you expend so much energy and so much emotion every time you're telling someone, that you're just so drained at the end, that it kind of got to the point where, you know, we told some people, and then it was kind of a case of, can you like start filtering this out for us, you know, to different friends and different friend groups, because I just didn't have the strength at that point to keep telling it over and over again. You know, I wasn't ready yet.
The thing that strikes me just when you're speaking about that, because it's when you get told news like that and you still go and pay for your parking,
yeah,
and stick on the indicator when you're turning right. You know, like all of these things that you do, you go home, like you take off your coat, like you just still find a way to function, even yeah, though you have been told something that is earth shattering. Yeah. Do you know what I mean, yeah, when I say that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember, you know, I one of my really close friends, Orla, at the time was living in New Zealand. And I just remember I had told her that morning I was going for my appointment. She's a doctor herself. And, you know, she was obviously waiting to hear. And I remember I just sent her a text. No, I didn't actually. Sorry, I phoned her. And I just broke down crying on the phone, and she was crying on the phone. And I just she just couldn't believe it. And I suppose hearing the reaction of my friends as well, it was just so hard. You know, obviously it's tough for the person who's gone through it, but it's also so difficult to see people you love, you know, so upset and so worried, and, you know, all the emotions that go with that. I'd say within an hour, a group of my friends had rallied around, had turned up at the house with, you know, sandwiches and cakes and tea and, you know, like just being like lovely. I'm so blessed with the friends that I have. And I remember then we went out for a walk in the park and we were laughing and joking. And, you know, they kept me going. You know, the friendships that I have with a lot of my friends would be very kind of, we try to make light of situation. Like, I think I coped very well, you know, using humour and kind of being a bit self-deprecating about it. And I suppose trying to make my friends feel comfortable around me that, you know, we can mention the word cancer, we can talk about the fact that I'm going to lose both my breasts. You know, I'm not going to crumble in a heap on the ground every time we talk about it. There might be sometimes I'm upset, but I wanted it to be like an open discussion. That people, you know, if there was something they wanted to know, that they could ask me. And, you know, it was therapeutic for me as well, because it meant that I never really shut myself off. I kind of just kept talking about it. And I think that really helped me a lot.
Did you feel like you were going to die?
Yeah, I did. I did feel I was going to die, because, you know, every time you go into that the doctor's office, you know, they're reassuring to you, but nobody can guarantee you anything. And they're saying, OK, we're going to have, you know, double mastectomy, and we're going to remove your breast tissue. And, you know, that'll hopefully, you know, get rid of the cancer. But also then you have to have chemotherapy, because if there's stray cancer cells in your body, you know, we need to try and kill them. But then also, if that isn't working, we need to have radiotherapy as another insurance policy just in case. And then the type I had was triple negative. So I suppose my fear was that I didn't have any follow on treatment from that. So they said chemotherapy works very well, but there was no kind of follow on drug that I could take. So I suppose I was fearful in that, OK, if this isn't working for me, what else do I have? What else can I do? And I made the mistake of, you know, I'm a massive Googler. I should not. Anything, even when I'm watching a film and who's that actor? Oh, I'll Google and I have to see what he's in. Like, I need to know a lot of information, which sometimes is good, but sometimes it's like the worst thing you can do. And I remember Googling about triple negative, and a lot of the research was old stats. And I was torturing myself looking at mortality rates, looking at what's the difference if you have surgery first or chemo first. Is there any difference? You know, does it matter if you get it at a younger age? Does it matter if, you know, you haven't gone through the menopause and you get it? I mean, I was up at night, you know. If my friends had have known I was doing that, they would have like shook me and said, stop this. But I just felt like I was kind of spiraling a bit at the start when I didn't know how I was going to react with chemo. I was frightened, you know.
And what sort of conversations did, you know, you were 30, single.
Yeah.
What sort of conversations was there around fertility? Because your journey with your baby is a huge part of your story. One of the reasons I wanted to get you on today, because people need to hear this story, that there is life after cancer, that you can find a way back. But at that time when you were 30 and they were speaking to you about fertility, what did they say?
So I remember speaking with my oncologist about it, and, you know, he said, you know, obviously you're young being diagnosed, which, you know, it works in your favor. But, you know, at the same time, we don't know what kind of damage chemotherapy can do to your reproductive system. And obviously, you know, I had the option of, you know, egg retrieval and that. But I think at the time I never gave that enough thought, to be totally honest. Like, I was given the information, but I don't think I realized the gravity of, you know, not going through with that, because ultimately I decided not to go through with egg retrieval. I think not being in a relationship possibly played a role of that in that. But I think as well, I was in such a headspace of, OK, I just want to start this treatment. I want to get on the road and I want to get better. So in my mind, anything else was a delay, which, you know, looking back was, you know, thankfully I didn't end up paying for that decision. But looking back, you know, if I had to do it again, I probably would have gone through with the egg retrieval to give myself an option or a chance. But as I said, I just wasn't in the mind frame to properly, you know, sit, you know, I didn't have a partner to sit down with and say, you know, how do you feel about this? What should we do? Yeah, I just wanted to start with my treatment. But
yeah, and you just want to survive. Like, yeah, nothing, not that nothing else matters, but you're just so focused on surviving. Yeah. The only reason that I did IVF after my diagnosis was because Jamie begged me to do it.
Yeah.
I was like, I can't do this. Yeah. I just, there's no way. I don't have the like physical or mental strength to do this IVF. And I think it's a really important point to talk about this because I think, you know, for anyone listening, it is a big kind of, oh God, now I have IVF on top of a cancer diagnosis and it's a lot to think about.
Yeah, super emotional, you know, for anybody going through that on top of, you know, treatment. But as I said, I chose in that moment not to go through it. And I suppose I then had to just live with the consequences of that decision, be it, you know, if I met someone and then my fertility was massively affected, you know, I made that choice. And, you know, as you alluded to there, like, thankfully, I didn't live to regret it. But it is a great option for people, you know, that anyone who is diagnosed with cancer, that option is there for people to do it. You know, it is great that it's offered.
Obviously, we could talk about treatment for hours, but chemotherapy is so tough. Radiotherapy is so tough. Will you tell me about the BRCA test? And when that came in terms of your diagnosis?
Yeah, so this is something that I haven't really spoken about before. In a lot of ways, I found it more devastating than the cancer diagnosis. I don't know if that might sound strange because of everything that goes with the cancer diagnosis, but I think all of the teams that I dealt with in Beaumont had recommended that I was put forward for a genetic testing. And due to my age and the type of breast cancer I had, so triple negative would be kind of associated with younger women and also with people with BRCA1 gene. Now, not always, but just the statistics are higher. So they said, you know, you could be waiting a few months for the test. There's a bit of a backlog for it, and they kind of you know, prioritize based on different factors. So I kind of wasn't expecting to hear for a while. And I think it was the November of 2018. So I'd been finished my treatment about 6 months at that point. And it was literally just a blood test. But, you know, they have a discussion with you before about, you know, family tree and family history, and they try to kind of see if there's any patterns. And there wasn't really in my family, to be honest. My auntie Sandra was diagnosed with breast cancer twice, and like, she's an amazing woman, and thankfully, like, she is healthy and she's thriving and she's so fabulous and glamorous, and like, she's such a, you know, role model for me. But apart from that, you know, there was no breast cancer in my family, you know, that we knew of, or ovarian cancer. So they talk you through like the potential implications of, you know, if you have it, are you ready, you know, for that, you know, because some people aren't. So they mightn't give you the test if they don't feel like you're, you know, emotionally able for it yet. So I remember I had the blood test and they said to me, it'll take about 3 months to get the results. Do you want to come back in for an appointment or do you want a phone call? And I said, oh no, just a phone call. It's fine. You know, phone calls are fine. And I remember then in January, I was actually speaking in RCSI at a Breast Cancer Ireland and talk about research into triple negative. And then I had to go back into work. So I was going into my last class of the day, and then this number like appeared on my phone, and I'm kind of strange at phone calls. If I don't know the number, I don't answer it. And then I Google the number. I know, my Googling again. Because like, usually it'll, if it, you know, sometimes there's a lot of those scam phone calls happening. So I Googled the number anyway, and it came up that it was St. James's genetic department. And I thought, oh, I better ring this back. So my work friend, Georgina, she, you know, was like, I'll stop at the class. You make the call. You know, it's important that you make the call. So she was, you know, I could see her through the glass. She was in with the class and I made the phone call and the lady was lovely. And she was like, OK, so, you know, we think we know now why you got breast cancer. And I thought, oh, no. What? Oh, no. I know what she's going to tell me. She said, OK, so you don't have BRCA2. We tested positive for, you know, faulty BRCA, the BRCA1 gene. And I just thought, OK, right. And she was trying to say, you know, do you know kind of what the implications of this are? And I was kind of reeling off all the stuff that I'd read. But, you know, again, it's information that I was relaying, but that I still couldn't feel it myself. I still couldn't think this is what's going to happen to me. You know, I was reading the information and I knew exactly what it meant, but I couldn't apply it to my life. So I was very kind of like, yeah, that's fine. Thanks. You know, great. OK, bye. And she was like, yeah, just ring me if you need more information. I was like, yeah, that's fine.
So what was the information?
So the information was basically that, you know, over the course of my lifetime, I'd have up to an 80 something percent chance of breast cancer, which, you know, I already had gotten. You know, they recommend a double mastectomy, which I'd had. So, you know, I was relieved in some way that I'd had that surgery, because I feel like coming through the cancer, having to relive all that again by going back for more surgery, I think would have been just so traumatic. But then, you know, the next thing was that you also could have up to a 60% chance of ovarian cancer over the course of your life. And also, you know, if you're to go on to have a baby, you have a 50% chance of passing on this gene. So I just, you know, I didn't really process it for a long time, to be honest. I went home and told my mom and she was very upset. I still was okay. And then I, you know, was telling my dad and he was very upset. And, you know, I didn't tell a lot of people about it because I wasn't ready to talk about it. I put it in a box for, I'd say, about 6 months. It was something that I wasn't ready to consider that surgery, you know, my ovaries removed and my fallopian tubes removed. I wasn't ready to think about getting that done. So I kept thinking, if I don't think about it, it's not actually happening. And to be honest, there's still a little bit of that with me now that, you know, each year it's looming closer and closer. You know, we're looking at probably maybe, I had a chat with someone in Beaumont about it and, you know, I'm looking at possibly 36, 37 of getting that surgery, and I'm 34 now, and I'm getting married in, you know, in 2023, and I'm thinking I don't want that surgery before the wedding because I don't know how I'm going to feel after that. I don't know, you know, I'm going to be straight into menopause. I'm going to, you know, you don't know what other side effects you're going to have. Again, I just won't want, you know, my wedding day, I want to feel like me. But I know at the same time, like, I'll do everything I can not to try and not have cancer again. You know, I want to be well. I have so many reasons to want to be well. And I just, I'll go through whatever I have to go through to do that. But I suppose I just choose to kind of be a bit ignorant with it for now because I don't want it to consume my life, because I'm so lucky that I was able to rebuild my life and, you know, create a lovely life for myself and my family and friends, that I don't want to be in a dark place and be constantly worrying, like, what if, what if, what if, you know.
Tell us about Keith.
So
at what point did he make an appearance?
So Keith and I actually met for the first time on a school trip when we were 17. But, you know, gradually would have lost touch. She ended up moving abroad and so I wouldn't have seen him for years. When he came back from New Zealand, he ended up retraining as a teacher, and he would have heard about me being sick, which, you know, actually helped a lot because it meant I didn't have to have this big, you know, drama of having to relive everything or building up to tell someone, because you just don't know how people are going to react. Some people are very funny about, they can't deal with people being sick, you know.
Yeah.
But there was a conference on in a school out in Sutton, for different subjects. We teach different subjects. And I remember at the break time, everyone was in the same lunchroom. And I just happened to look up and he happened to look up and we saw each other and we thought, oh my God, hi, how are you? And we were just chatting for a few minutes and that was it. Okay, so
I'm just looking at Fergal. He's producing this podcast and he is beaming, like the smile.
It was so strange. Again, it was like one of those things where I felt like, you know, we kind of inadvertently over a couple of years, there was things that was overlapping that we were kind of, you know, timing just wasn't right, or, you know, we weren't at the same place at the same time. But then like eventually we were. And then, yeah, so about 2 weeks later, one of my friends, Deirdre, it was her engagement party. And, you know, Deirdre is a great friend to me, a very special friend to me. She was actually the lady who I was with when I met you in the wig shop.
Oh, yeah.
So she was really trying to push me back out into like the dating scene and I wasn't having a bar of it. I was like, no, I'm just focusing on myself. You know, I'm happy now to be feeling good again. And, you know, just I felt like I was like thriving again. And she was like, no, OK, who do you know that, you know, you could go on a date with? We need to get you out on a date. And I was like, oh, for God's sake. And she had said, you mentioned that you'd bumped into someone who you were friends with years ago. Why don't you ask him out? I said, Deirdre, I could never do that. Oh, my goodness. I never in my life would have done anything like that. But I did. So I messaged him and I said, it was really great to see you a couple of weeks ago. I know this message is very random, but I'm just wondering, would you like to like properly catch up sometime? No problem at all. And I didn't hear anything back. And I thought, oh, Deirdre, I'm cursing, you know. And about 2 days later, I was with my friend Cara down in Seafield and I was telling her all about this and she was saying, oh, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. You'll hear from him. You'll hear from him. But I'd say in her mind, she was thinking, you are not going to hear from him. So next thing, my phone beeped and it was him. And he had said, oh, I'm so sorry. I was away in Hamburg. And the second I got on the plane, I blocked my pin. I couldn't get your message till now. I'd love to meet you. Yeah. And it was like a whirlwind. Like from the first time we went out, we just clicked. I just, you know, he said from like the third date in, he's like, I knew that this was it. I knew that I was going to be with you. I knew that, like, he's like, I know it sounds so strange. Like, how could you know? But he said, I just knew that this was going to be it for us.
And did you ever think, like in the depths of treatment, that this would happen?
Never. I never in a million years thought, you know, I just thought, you know, marriage and babies and maybe a relationship, it mightn't be on the cards for you. And that is absolutely fine. You know, you don't need to have somebody to be happy. You've so much, you know, love in your life already. And as I said, I'm surrounded by the best people. I love my job. I teach the most beautiful children. Who were so supportive to me throughout everything. So, you know, I had a lot already that I was very grateful for. But no, I never thought that that would happen, and especially in the way that it did happen. And I suppose part of the reason why I knew, you know, this could be it was that I was very open with them, you know, at the start of our relationship in terms of the gene I had, in terms of, you know, the treatment I've had, that, you know, I don't know whether children were going to be an option for me. You know, I don't know in terms of the future, what my health, what things could hold. And I just said to him, you know, it's early enough in the relationship. I want to be open and frank with you. I'm not trying to be morbid. I'm not trying to be negative. But, you know, I just want to give you basically an out that if you can handle that, we can just go our separate ways and that's fine. I just don't want to be 5 years down the road and then a massive problem. I don't want you to resent me. And he couldn't have been more amazing. You know, he's like, I don't care about any of that. I'm with you. If we don't have children, I'm happy with you. You're enough for me. And like hearing somebody say that, you know, after, you know, a few years of obviously have incredible friends and, you know, you're seeing everybody else kind of moving on with their lives and, you know, some of my closest friends getting married and that, you know, brought me so much joy, and some of my closest friends having babies. And I suppose at the time when I was at my lowest, I never knew if, you know, I'd get the opportunity to move on with my life. And I suppose when we met and I knew and I felt that I was enough for him, just me, it just was a very kind of special feeling that you're enough for somebody just as you are, flaws and everything and uncertainty. Yeah, that's when I knew for sure that, you know, this is the person for me. He is the one. Yeah, absolutely.
So tell us then what happened next with Sam. Because there's a group of us in Breast Cancer Ireland ambassadors and, you know, we have a WhatsApp group, and I'll never forget you putting in the news that you were pregnant. And I think for all of us, like, it cut deep with all of us, I think, what you were going through. And we all had the fear that you wouldn't experience having a baby of your own. So when you said, when you sent us the scan, it was the most incredible moment. I think, whoa, we were all just floored, but so happy for you.
Yeah, we, like, you know, we were together a while then, and I don't know how we got so lucky or so blessed, but I ended up, the following year, I ended up falling pregnant. And I'm pretty in tune with my body that kind of early on, I said to him, I think I might be pregnant. And he said, you couldn't be. He said, I think I am. And this was like, we're in the middle of the pandemic now, so you know, we could barely get into a chemist. It was like pandemonium. Like, how do I check? How do I find out? You know, trying to get a test and stuff like that. So it turns out that I was. And obviously, I think I was only a couple of weeks at that stage. So obviously, you know, everything, I was still very cautious and I was very frightened. And we didn't tell kind of people for a long time. We obviously just told, like, our parents was really all we told until we got our first scan, until we knew that everything was okay, because obviously you know, so many people go through miscarriages and have such a tough time, and I just didn't want to take anything for granted. And then, you know, with the pregnancy, I know my mom was very worried initially about me. She was worried whether, you know, is this going to have an effect on you? Is it going to make you unwell again? And, you know, I was in Hollis Street and the team were just amazing that, you know, initially, like, I was seen all the time. They kind of had me in and out all the time checking. And thankfully, he was thriving and he was, you know, everything was going as it should be. And yeah, I suppose as the months went on, I kind of relaxed a bit more into it and was like, okay, this is actually happening now, you know, because it felt like a dream for so long. And because we were in lockdown, I didn't really get to see people. So I was kind of, in some ways, it was sad because, you know, you want to be surrounded, you want to share your joy with everyone, but in other ways, I suppose, you felt very safe and kind of in a bubble. And I'll never forget the day that we told people, and again, I started making phone calls, and I was like on the phone nonstop, and, you know, sending messages. And I just could not believe how happy people were for me. I know that might sound odd, like, and of course people are always happy when someone is pregnant, but, like, it made people so emotional when they heard I was pregnant. I think it was almost like a full circle moment of, they'd been with me, you know, before everything happened. They'd been with me at my lowest moment. They'd been with me when I was building myself up again. They were with me when I got into a relationship, and then the culmination of this, like, miracle, magical baby that was going to come into our world. I mean, it was just incredible. Like, the support was incredible. It's just something I'll never forget.
What did you think when you first saw him? Like, when you first held him, what was running through your mind?
I just couldn't believe I just couldn't believe he was there. Keith still laughs at me because I feel like every few days I still say, Sam's our baby. And he's like, yeah, Emma, I know Sam's our baby. He's nearly 10 months old. I'm like, yeah, but like, he is ours. Like, can you believe it? Like, it's just, I still, every time I look at him and like when I wake up in the morning and like I'm excited to see his little face, like looking out of the cot, I just still get that rush of, I cannot believe I got so lucky that I got to have him. I feel like I've won the lottery.
I'll get straight back to my conversation, but first I wanted to thank Vichy for supporting the Good Glow and tell you all about their new hero product, Mineral 89 Probiotic Serum. Recently, through working with Vichy and speaking to their skincare experts, I learned that stress can affect our skin and how it looks. Over the past few years, I've learned about the importance of de-stressing. So what can we do for our skin? Well, Vichy's new Mineral 89 Probiotic Serum targets acutely stressed skin and supports the repair of skin barrier damage. Mineral 89 Probiotics is proven to visibly improve dullness, elasticity, stress lines, and overall radiance for the recharge of stressed skin needs. It's dermatologist tested, hypoallergenic, and fragrance free. It can be used every morning and night after cleansing your skin prior to your moisturizer. For a 20% Mars Pharmacy discount on Mineral 89 Skin Booster and Mineral 89 Probiotic Fraction Serum, use code GOODGLOW20 online only at mars.ie until November 30th.
Do you think, this is such a weird question, I know, but like, would you change it? Obviously you have Keith and Sam, yeah. And when you think about them and you think about your life now.
Yeah.
It's such a weird, I'm so uncomfortable with that because it's brought so much to my life, you know, in terms of even just my own health. I feel better now than I ever did. I look after myself. I've, you know, there's just little things that I do that I feel happier
like
and healthier.
You're in a career now that like you've such a passion for.
Yeah. You know, purpose.
Yeah. No, do you know what? And it's so funny that you asked this question because I had this conversation with Keith a few months ago and I wouldn't change it. Because, you know, cancer is not my identity, but so much has come from it that there's no way I could change it. You know, I've met my partner. I have a beautiful baby. I've met incredible friends. We became friends. You know, we became part of like an incredible charity, Breast Cancer Ireland, who does so much work. I'd still be in contact with strangers who I've never met, who would still message me, ask me how I am. Like sometimes social media can be the absolute worst and just bring out the most toxic people. But when, you know, the chips are down and you're going through something, you know, like we've been through, it can be so magical and it can be such a place of support and love, and people can be so kind, and like message from someone could just turn around your whole day.
Yeah.
And now I feel like, you know, obviously everything you're doing with your podcast and, you know, your wellness cards and, you know, all the talks you do and all the awareness you bring, like before your diagnosis, think of the amount of women that might not have checked themselves, that might not have listened to their body, that might not have put themselves first. And now, like, because you went through everything, you've gone through that. Some other woman might not have had to go through it.
Mm. And that's exactly how you know? I feel about you. And anytime I heard you on, like, Pat Kenny and, you know, I just think you're so articulate about cancer and encouraging women to check themselves, which is, you know, part of your purpose now.
Definitely.
And when you have people like Audrey Hamilton and Rosie Conley using their business to raise money for Breast Cancer Ireland, and it's Breast Cancer Awareness Month, so I just wanted to touch on it.
Yeah.
For me, when I see women who haven't had breast cancer do things like that, I'm like, this is what we need. We need money for research. The money that is raised for Breast Cancer Ireland goes directly into research, which is why I work with them. And I think
it's hugely important because I suppose, you know, all of the other services are so worthy also, you know. But research is where we're going to find, you know, alternative treatments. It's the reason why now not everybody has to get chemotherapy, you know. That used to be a standard practice. Every single person would get chemotherapy, you know, and people who wouldn't benefit from it would still have to go through that torture. Whereas now, you know, they have they do the testing and they'll see if you'll actually benefit from chemotherapy. And if it's the case that you won't, you know, there's other targeted drugs and stuff that you can take. And I think even, you know, money going into research to find out things like that are incredible. And there's always discoveries and breakthroughs happening. And we know through Breast Cancer Ireland, like, they're always keeping us informed and keeping everyone informed, you know, where that money's going and the discoveries that have been made. And it's just like mind blowing that people can actually do these things.
I know. Thank you so much for opening up today. I know speaking about BRCA is so difficult for you. I love you.
I love you too. Thank you so much for having me.
Hello, Martine.
Hi, Georgie. How are you?
Thank you so much for chatting to me today. I know that you have a lot on. I just wanted to check in with you. I think it's really important for me on this episode during Breast Cancer Awareness Month to actually check in with somebody who is going through breast cancer at the moment. How are you feeling?
Today is a good day. I take every day as it comes, but today is great. So today I feel really good.
Oh, that's so good to hear. And that's such a great way to look at things, just taking things one day at a time. Tell us a little bit about the day that you found a lump in your breast.
Oh, we were on holiday at the time, and the day was just, as you are on holiday, really lovely, relaxing day. And I was putting, you know, cream on after the shower, and I found the lump. And of course, we all think it's nothing. We just think, oh, if this is a lump, I have to go get it checked. You know, I'm sure it's nothing. And then Sean and I went and done a helicopter ride. I didn't think at the time it was cancer. I don't think I would have thought at 29 years of age, I would have two lumps in my breast that would have been cancer. But they were. And at the time, I just try to remain positive and think it's going to be okay.
Your fiance Sean has been a great support and with you every step of the way. What was his reaction when you said to him that you found a lump in your breast?
Well, I actually got him to double check because I thought, am I feeling something that's not there? Is it in my head? And as soon as he felt it, he says, he looked at me straight in the eye and I could tell he was a bit afraid. And he just says, let's not worry about it now. We're on holiday. We'll go to the doctor on Monday. Now looking back and when we talk about it, he knew at that time that it didn't feel right because they were quite big and they were quite hard. But he kind of knew. I think he thought that it was going to, he wanted it to be okay, but he was really, really afraid, like really afraid. And I could see that in his eyes, but we tried to push everything to the side because we were actually getting on a helicopter ride in a couple of hours time. And that was good because it kind of meant that we were thinking of something else other than the lumps that we found in my breast. But I remember sitting on the helicopter and my hand just kept going to my chest and I was like feeling the lumps again. And I was going, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. They're just lumps. You know, they're going to get removed. They're probably benign. They're going to be nothing. And, you know, never my wildest dreams that I think, you know, 5 months later, I'm sitting here halfway through my chemotherapy with no hair and my eyebrows are hanging on with a deer thread. But yeah, he has been the best support the whole way through. And I don't know how I could do this without him here, honestly.
What was it like being told that you had cancer on the other side of the world? Like, I know Australia is your home now, but away from your family.
To be honest, I feel like I had an out-of-body experience. I can't really describe it, but I remember sitting, when I went to the doctor, I had these two words I kept saying, I'm brave and these are benign. They were my two words that I kept talking about. And I kept saying, the doctor's going to tell me, you know, good news, it's benign, but, and I was ready for surgery or something else that was going to happen to remove the lumps. But when she said, it's bad news, it's cancer, I just felt like I had an out-of-body experience where I was in the corner of the room in the surgery, and I was looking down on me and Sean, and I was just thinking, that's awful, that poor girl's 29. That awful, like, that's so bad. But that was me. And I had never felt so far away from home in my entire life. Like, in that second, I just thought, why am I in Australia? Why am I so far away from my mommy and my daddy and my two sisters and my three nieces? Like, it felt like we had been on the other side of the world. Well, it was kind of like a reality. We are on the other side of the world and we're in a pandemic and we can't go home and we're stuck in Australia and my parents are stuck in Ireland. Like, how is this going to work? Like, how am I going to get through this? It was real shock to the system.
What did you do the night that you go home after you're told this news? And as you said, your family can't be with you. But how did you process that night, or what did you do?
So my family were actually up waiting for me to ring them because they knew what time I had the appointment. And I think Sean and I were in the doctors a bit longer than we thought we were. I think time had kind of, you kind of lose track of time. Like, you don't really know. I remember listening to you on your podcast and you were saying you were driving home and, you know, that feels like it's a very, very long time, but there was like maybe 2 hours had happened. But I just remember once we got home and we FaceTimed everyone and broke the news, we just had to tell our friends about it because then we were able to welcome them into our home and just try and like make noise, like talk, make noise, make tea. Like, we just didn't want to be sitting on our own. And the first night when we went to bed, I just remember thinking, like, am I going to die? Like, how long do I have to live? Like, what's it going to look like? And in my head, I was like, I'm 29. I've been training flat out for the last like 2 years, waiting on this wedding that's never going to bloody happen, you know, using all my creams and potions and trying to look my best. And I know that my body's going to be butchered. You know, I am going to be baldy. Like, all this is ahead of me. Like, what has become of my life? And at that moment in time, you kind of think, you can't really see past the next day. All you can see is the couple of hours ahead of you. And I just remember Sean and I lying in bed and we were just talking for hours and hours and hours and hours. And I think we talked so much and I was so drained that I just, you know, kind of conked out. And that's how we got through the first night. But it was just talking to as many people as possible, trying to stay happy, laugh. And I think that just the exhaustion just knocked me out that night.
You went on a journey then to try get your parents into Australia. You campaigned, you wrote to politicians, all the Irish community in Australia got behind you, which is so heartwarming. Tell us about the moment that you saw your parents. How much longer after you were diagnosed was that reunion?
So I was diagnosed on the 5th of June and my parents got out of mandatory quarantine on the 29th of July. So it's quite hard because at the time when my parents got here, they had to do 14-day mandatory quarantining in a hotel in Sydney. So they were in the country. I knew they were there and I couldn't see them. I couldn't touch them. I couldn't go up and give them a hug. And it was nice to know they were in the country and they were so close, but yet they were still so far. So those 2 weeks they were in quarantine and Sean and I were like, you know, we were like cooks and Uber drivers, like just bringing them stuff because I just wanted to be known that they were in the hotel and I was outside. And then once the 2 weeks were up and they got out, just that initial hug, I just remember running towards my parents. They both had two t-shirts on that said Martine's Army and there was my photo on it, like supporting me. And I ran over and just threw my arms around my mum and then my dad threw his arms around the both of us and we just stood there crying and hugging for maybe like 10, 15 minutes. And I think everyone in the hotel quarantine was looking at us. And there were security guards because it's so strict, so, so strict with COVID. And it was just the best feeling in the world. And then, of course, Sean got in on the act and we were all just standing outside hugging for, you know, like the best part of 10 minutes. And I just remember my mommy whispering into my ear saying, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. And my daddy was like, we love you. Everything's going to be all right. And I was like, oh, those 2 weeks in quarantine were worth it. The stress to get my parents here with the exemption was worth it. And when I look back in the last 3 months, I just think, how can I have done it without them? How could anyone go through this without their parents there? Like, I'm very, very lucky to have them here.
Oh my God. God, I'm so emotional listening to that, because I think when your mom says everything's going to be okay, it's just so reassuring, isn't it? Because no matter how old you are, once your mom, you know, wraps their arms around you and tells you everything's going to be okay, you believe it.
I think it did, because I was always trying to hold things together. You know, you're always trying to, when you go on FaceTime to the ones at home, you're trying to be positive and you're trying to, you know, put on a brave face. But when they're living with you, you can't do it all the time. And you do have to just show them your emotion. So it meant that I felt like I could kind of let go a little bit and just breathe in and just relax. And, you know, small things that your mom does, like she'll put the kettle on or she'll put the wash on. Whereas I was always like, I have to do this, I have to do that, I have to stay in like action mode. But as soon as I got here, I was like, right, I can just let go now and focus on myself. Obviously, I could do that with Sean here, but it also meant that he had the support as well, because he'd been like me. We were just in action mode the whole time. But as soon as they got here, like, we just have to show the emotion that we're feeling there and then, and just let go. And like, we all cry together, we all laugh together. And when you do things together, you're much more stronger than on your own.
Yeah, and this is a time in your life that you'll just never, ever forget. But tell us about, I'm really interested in your daily kind of rituals and things that you're doing to get yourself through this time. Because I think, you know, I chat to Sean a bit when I'm just checking in. Sometimes I don't want to be bothering you the whole time, but he's always down at the beach, you know, sunrise. I know that you're with him. Is that kind of part of your healing journey?
100%. Before, you know, before I ever started this journey, we were always sunrise people. And, you know, getting up in the morning, I take my dog down for a walk. Sean goes down and takes his photographs. And that's been our ritual. And I think part of me really wants to keep things normal as possible. I want to keep the routine. But especially now that if I can get up in the morning and make it down for a sunrise, I'm absolutely winning. Like, this is a good day. I'm Martine today. Like, I'm really, really strong. But I think whenever you're sick, well, this is how I feel. When I go to bed, bed's not my favorite time. Like, I don't like now going to sleep because I know I'm going to be up with the hot flushes. But knowing that I'm going to wake up to a beautiful sunrise, it gets me out of bed in the morning and it starts my day off right. Sitting there with a coffee is just the best feeling in the world, and it's something to look forward to. And usually then the routine around the day involves like a lovely walk with the dog. We'll come back and have lovely breakfast. But I do try to journal a lot. And it's funny, at the start of the year, I started a gratitude journal where in January the 1st, I started writing down three things I was grateful for every day. And I feel like that has really helped prepare me for what my life has thrown at me this year, because I'm still grateful every day, even if I'm sick and I'm really tired and I'm nauseous and I'm just feeling like real, you know, rubbish. Being grateful for something just helps me feel normal. It helps me feel happy. You know, I could be grateful for, I'm always grateful for small things in my life, but, you know, getting up and having a shower that day, I'm just grateful to have a shower. I'm grateful for hot water. I'm grateful to feel the water running down my head. You know, it's like, I'm grateful for not having her today because I was ready in 5 minutes. Yes. You know, small things like that. You know, you'd be grateful for the smallest things. And I just try and find it, the positives and all the negatives. Like, yes, it means that, you know, I have to wear a wig, but how lucky am I that I get to wear a wig every day or whatever day that I want, and it's sitting there perfect, ready to go. You don't need to do anything to it. So it's just about being grateful, journaling, writing down my thoughts. I had some quite dark days, and I have, you know, I've been honest about them and said, like, it's not all rainbows. And the dark days, when I write down in my journal, I'm able to look back on it and say, God, that was a dark day. So I know that if another dark day comes, I know it's going to end. It's just a day.
Yeah.
The good days come and the bad days come. And I think you just have to realize that.
What are your days like now? And do you look ahead or do you just try to stay in the present?
I would say I do both at the minute. So particularly where I'm at with my treatment, I always want to know what's ahead of me so I can prepare. So for example, like losing your hair, I wanted to be prepared for that. I want to be prepared knowing that I'm going to have chemo up until the 4th of January. So I always try to prepare ahead and look to see what's ahead, but I still very much am present in the moment. For example, like if I'm good today, it's the best day in the world. Like I'm going to focus on today and make the most of today. Knowing that I've got chemo up until, like I said, the 4th of January, I try and give myself little goals to do each month, or it could be each week. So obviously October is breast cancer awareness. And for me, it's like I'm going to have little mini goals, and it's like I want to walk 100K this month. This is the first I've said it out loud, so I'm actually holding myself to it now. But like I'll just try and give myself little goals and work towards it. But being present in that day is important, because sometimes, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day. You don't have to know every single thing that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. But for me, just being prepared, knowing that I do have 12 more chemos. I'm starting Taxol soon, which is a new drug. So there's a bit of anxiety around that. You know, how am I going to react? Is it going to be good? You know, am I going to get tingles in my fingers? Like all that is, you know, I'll be up all night on Monday night knowing that I'm going in for that on Tuesday. But I think you just have to kind of bring yourself back to reality and think, now is good, so enjoy the moment.
Yeah. What have you learned about yourself?
I've learned I'm tough. I'm a tough cookie. That I feel like I'm rolling with the punches, and I'm allowing myself to be flexible. And that even I feel like even though I'm still, I think I've learned to accept help, and that's something that I had to change about myself. You know, I think I find it quite hard to accept help from other people. You know, if someone says, oh, you let me do this for you, I'm like, no, it's okay. I can do it myself. But I've now learned to say, do you know what? That would be great. Could you do that? That would be perfect. You know, when I got diagnosed, friends were like, oh, I'll help do the admin, you know, cancel your gym membership. And I was like, no, it's fine. I can do it myself. But as soon as they took that away from me and they were able to do it, I was able to then just concentrate on myself. So just learning to accept help, and also showing the emotion, like, you don't have to be strong all the time. You can show emotion, and it doesn't mean that you're weak. It actually means that you're strong enough because you're vulnerable. And I think just being grateful for life. I think now I've really understood the meaning of life, and to know that it can be taken away from you in a few seconds, or your life can just change in a few seconds, that I do really cherish life. And I suppose my perspective on life has changed. You know, it's not around climbing the corporate ladder, working so many hours. You know, your social status, your work status, it doesn't really mean anything if you don't have your health, and your health is your wealth. So kind of grounded myself and coming back to basics and focusing on family and just being healthy in yourself.
And what is the plan for your parents then? Do you think there's any part of them that is tempted to stay and live the dream in Australia?
Oh, definitely. Absolutely. I think my parents have been lucky enough to come here before. So they understand why I'm here and why I've chose to live here.
Yeah.
For now.
Are you, not happy is the wrong word, but are you okay with the fact that you were diagnosed there? Like, do you feel like it was meant to be that way?
That was a massive decision for us, because once I got diagnosed, I think Sean's initial reaction was, we have to go home. Whereas my reaction was, but we don't know home. We don't know the healthcare system at home. We've been here for 7 years. Like, especially with COVID as well, we were thinking, like, it was a massive decision that we had to make. And we decided to stay here because, you know, I had an appointment with the cancer clinic here. And from my first appointment, they had mapped out, you know, my next 10 appointments. Everything was set in stone. And I just said to Sean, I feel like we should be here. And I do feel that we were meant to be here, and our parents were meant to come out here, because I feel like I've got, this is my home. This is where I'm settled. You know, we'd have to bring our dog back. We'd have to like sell everything. It would have been too stressful. However, would I love to have my cousins and my friends and my sisters all around me all the time? Yes, because it is very, very hard to do it without all the support. And it's also a strain on my parents as well, and Sean, because it's just us in terms of our family. We've obviously got friends here, but to have your family there with you you know, it would be absolutely amazing. But hopefully in the new year, I can go home for a holiday and just, you know, give everyone the biggest cuddle in the world.
I think for breast cancer now, for lots of women, they get to get their life back. And it's, of course, not the same for everybody, but early detection saved your life and saved my life and saved Emma's life. I think it's really nice that people share their stories now, especially young women, because, you know, like you said, when you go to bed at night and your mind starts racing, that's when all the fearful thoughts come in. But to have people that you say, oh, well, Emma survived it, or Georgie survived it, or, you know, Kylie Minogue, Juliana Rancic, you know, the more people that tell their stories and give the next people hope, I think it's really important if you have the strength to tell your story. And you've been doing that. And oh my God, I just can't stop watching your stories and your journey. And you're just doing such an incredible job.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. You're 100% right. And, you know, one bad case, or, you know, one death that is linked to breast cancer, it kind of does overshadow, it could be 10 good stories. So I think that's why it's very important, you know, for any woman or man that gets through this illness, whatever illness it may be, cancer in general, you know, the more positive news that we share, it just helps lift all of us women up and just gives us a little bit more empowerment. And you're right that you just have to, I actually get a bit of strength from sharing my story, because since I have shared it, I've had a lot of people reach out to me and say, this was me 25 years ago, this was me 30 years ago. And I'm like, yes, you're my hero. I love you so much. And it just gives you a bit more positive, like that little kick that you need, like that little kick up the backside to say, right, come on, you know, stop sulking today, get out and get your steps in, drink your water, take your vitamins, like just try and stay positive.
Oh, Martine, you're absolutely amazing. Thank you so much for your time today. I know you're in the middle of treatment, you've got a lot going on. You've been so generous with your time, so thank you. And you'll have to come back on the Good Glow and tell your story in full someday.
Yeah. Oh, I would love that. I would absolutely love that. But I really appreciate your time as well. Thank you so much.
Sending you so much love, and we're all with you every single step of the way. So keep going and stay strong.
Thanks, Georgie.
Thank you so much to my guests, Emma and Martine, for sharing their stories with me today. Just before I go, I just wanted to say that I wanted to dedicate this episode to our friend Orla Byrne, who is in the middle of her breast cancer journey. And I mentioned that briefly on my Instagram post yesterday, and I just wanted to read out the powerful words that Orla wrote underneath that post. She said, "For anyone entering this arena of unwanted illness, always remember and channel the fact that you are 100% stronger than you know." So sending Orla and anybody else who is in the middle of a breast cancer journey all my love. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Good Glow podcast, brought to you with thanks to Vichy. If you did, please feel free to leave me a review and subscribe. As I said at the start of the podcast, there is a very small amount of tickets available for my National Concert Hall show on November 2nd, available over on nch.ie. I'll see you next week.